Welcome to Eat, Capture, Share, the podcast for food bloggers, food lovers, and everyone in between. My name is Kimberly. I'm your host. Episode 7. Hey everybody, welcome back to the Eat, Capture, Share podcast. Delighted that you're here for another episode. Today is, I dare say, maybe one of my most favorite interviews that I've done so far. I feel that if the podcast were to end today, I would have done not my life's work, but I would have put something really important out into the world. And not so much me, but it's more about my guest, Christy Harrison. Christy is an anti-diet registered dietitian, certified intuitive eating counselor, author, and the host of the Food Psych podcast. In short, she's really the best person I know to talk about intuitive eating and also the responsibility we all have as food bloggers and as food Instagrammers who post their food and all the stuff that we eat and don't eat on our Instagram grid. Now, two things I'd like to kind of flag before we move into the episode. Firstly, if you've got any eating disorders, disordered eating, or are just in a kind of vulnerable space when it comes to eating, orthorexia, or what have you, then just be cautious in terms of the content of this podcast may trigger something for you. So I'm just putting that out there. The second thing is, you may be listening to this and going, well, I don't have orthorexia. I don't do healthy eating. This podcast episode isn't for me. But I would say, please do listen. I think even if you don't post healthy, Whole 30, paleo, or what have you, this podcast interview still has so much that you can take away. Because ultimately, as food bloggers, we have a huge responsibility to our audience. And there are certain things that we may be doing that we're not even aware of that can trigger certain eating patterns and eating behaviors in the people that really enjoy our content the most and the people that we value the most, our audience. So without further ado, here she is. Great. Thank you so much, Christy, for agreeing to be on the Eat, Capture, Share podcast. I'm so excited to have you.
Thank you so much, Kimberly. So excited to be here.
Now, I know you really well because I am a loyal listener of your podcast, but in case there's anybody who's tuning in who has not come across your work before, would you be so kind as to introduce yourself?
Absolutely. So I'm Christy Harrison. I'm a anti-diet registered dietitian and certified intuitive eating counselor based in Brooklyn, New York in the States. And I help people heal their relationships with food and their bodies and break free from diet culture.
Amazing. Now, the word intuitive eating is kind of almost a little bit of a buzzword at the moment, but I'm not 100% sure I really know what it means. So would you be able to kind of explain it a little bit more?
Sure. Yeah, it definitely has become kind of a buzzword these days. It sort of has two meanings. The first is that it's the default mode. As I always say, it's really how we were born eating. It's the way that we were programmed from birth to relate to food. But the other meaning is that it's a system of principles that you can work through to help you get back to that default mode. So when I say I'm an intuitive eating coach, what I do is, you know, work through those principles with people to help them ultimately not need me anymore, basically, to help them get back to being able to be in charge of their own food, their own movement choices, you know, their own life, really.
I was going to say, because, you know, like what I see a lot on social media is people saying, you know, just listen to your body and just eat what your body tells. But the thing is, if you put me in a candy store, my body will tell me to eat everything. So clearly that's not what that's about.
Yeah, it's really complicated, actually, which is why people like intuitive eating coaches exist, because, you know, we are all born knowing how to do it, but then we get so waylaid and so sidetracked by diet culture, which is this system of beliefs that we're all born into in Western culture, which says larger bodies are not okay, that you have to shrink your body in order to be worthy, that certain styles of eating and certain types of foods are good and should be elevated, and other styles of eating and foods should be demonized and are bad and should be off limits. And, you know, we get these messages from birth that tell us, like, your weight isn't right, your body is wrong, your eating is wrong, you need to do this, you need to do that. You know, there's all these voices coming from all different directions telling you what to do. So we really do get so far away from that intuitive relationship with food that is our birthright that it gets very confusing. And so for a lot of people, and myself included, because I have my own history of disordered eating and recovery and coming back to intuitive eating, but I remember feeling the same way when I was in my, you know, dieting days or pre-intuitive eating, well, pre-second time around intuitive eating days. You know, I was like, oh, get those cookies away from me because I can't be around them without polishing off the entire bag. You know, like I can't keep certain foods in the house because if I do, I'm just going to eat the whole thing. And these days I keep those same foods in the house for months sometimes, you know, and eat them when I want and work my way through the bag without binging on them, without feeling compelled to, you know, go to them every second. I can be in a candy store and get what I want and leave without feeling, you know, stuffed or uncomfortable, because I've gotten back into a relationship with all food where it's, where I'm at peace with every kind of food, where there's nothing that's off limits and where, you know, candy has the same moral value as an apple or a green smoothie, which is to say like no actual moral benefit or value to any of them. And so that is a tricky process, you know, to get back to that place where you can allow foods to be neutral and allow your body to be in charge and listen to your body to tell you what it wants. Because when you've been restricted and deprived through dieting and through the modern guise of diet culture, which I call the wellness diet, which is like wellness masquerade, you know, it's masquerading as health and wellness, but it's really still a diet just by another name, where it's telling you to cut out gluten, it's telling you to cut out dairy, it's telling you to avoid all these kinds of foods and that, you know, you should only be eating a certain way. That kind of deprivation creates a really strong pull in the opposite direction. I liken it to a pendulum. You know, when you swing a pendulum, you pull it to one side, it has to have an equal and opposite reaction. It has to swing all the way to the other side and keep swinging back and forth until eventually, without any more intervention, it will just land in the middle. But if you keep pulling on it by restricting, you keep ending up swinging over into this, you know, binging territory or eating to uncomfortable levels of fullness and feeling really bad about yourself. And then oftentimes what happens, because we live in diet culture and we have this system of beliefs that tells us that, you know, eating the wrong quote unquote kinds of foods is bad, or that we are not supposed to binge or whatever, we end up swinging back intentionally to restriction, being like, okay, I'm not going to do that again. I'm going to cleanse, I'm going to atone for the binge. And then it sets up that same pendulum again. So, you know, to be able to get to that peaceful place in the middle where you're not swinging back and forth really requires letting go of the restriction.
That's so interesting. There's two things that I'd really like to pick up on, actually, if that's okay with you. So the first thing that I'm hearing you say, which I wasn't aware of, but makes total sense, is that yes, intuitive eating is this buzzword, but it's almost like people have Googled it and then kind of made it their own on Instagram without any sort of qualifications. And then actually what I hear you say is that to be able to eat intuitively for many of us, because of the diet culture, et cetera, isn't just a straightforward thing, which, am I getting that right?
Absolutely. Yeah. And I would say, you know, even add to that, like with diet culture and the deprivation and restrictions and disordered eating that so many people have within this culture, oftentimes people get so disordered about food that it actually does sort of shut down lines of communication between the body and the brain, especially when someone has like a full-blown eating disorder where they've been significantly restricting or significantly binging or using compensatory behaviors like bulimia. People's system gets really out of whack. And so like listening to your body in those cases often doesn't help and isn't effective and in fact can be harmful and drive you further into the disorder.
Yeah.
Because, you know, if you're struggling with restrictive eating and anorexia, for example, and you quote unquote listen to your body, well, the disorder, the eating disorder actually causes your body to have dulled hunger signals and usually or oftentimes excessive or early signs of fullness before you're actually full. Your body tells you it's full. It's just those mechanisms are sort of out of whack because the disease, it just causes that. And so if you were to go from restrictive eating like anorexia into trying to do intuitive eating, it would often make it's likely to make the eating disorder worse. It's likely, mm-hmm. likely to make the restriction and starvation worse because you're not going to be getting the signals that tell you as much as you really need to eat.
That's so interesting. Now, the second thing that you said that I really want to kind of take further, just so you know, like my food blog is a predominantly plant-based food blog. And the reason I started it was because I, you know, transitioned to a predominantly plant-based diet and I felt great. And I really wanted to share these recipes, healthy and not so healthy, as it were, with, you know, with the world. And I know that this kind of wish to share something that's made you feel amazing, be it paleo or keto, whatever it is, that for many people, this sort of, you know, wonderful eating experience is what triggers them to start a food blog and share their recipes. And so I'm kind of wondering, do we as food bloggers have a certain responsibility in terms of how we portray our own diet, how we communicate that, especially on Instagram? I don't know if you have any thoughts or views around that.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I think it's really tricky because mm-hmm. food bloggers have a platform and yes. there's people coming to you who are in a vulnerable state. You know, it's unfortunately because of the culture we live in, you know, everybody is increasingly obsessed with food these days.
I think
diet culture and the restriction and deprivation that it creates makes people even more attuned to food cues. They're actually, their brains have heightened responses to food that you don't see in people who are not restricting or deprived. So, you know, oftentimes, and this was my experience too, like I was a very disordered eater. I had an eating disorder that was undiagnosed when I finished college and I was going into a career as a journalist. And the beat that I stumbled upon because of how obsessed I was with food because I was so hungry and not eating it enough yeah. was to write about food. So I became a food writer and a nutrition writer. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was writing these articles about food, nutrition, and health and had this sort of mandate to just spend all day diving deep into that research and reading articles and editing articles about this stuff. And it really exacerbated the disordered behaviors I had with food because, mm-hmm. you know, suddenly I was just immersed in this world where I was thinking about food 24/7 and I had this sort of license to, you know, because of my profession, like this license to do all that research and I was getting paid for it.
Yeah.
And, you know, so I think a lot of us in this food space, people who go into food blogging or Instagram or, you know, any sort of related field like this where we're doing media that's related to food, a lot of people have their own issues when they come into it.
Yes,
and a lot of people in our audience have those issues too
yes.
because they're seeking out that information.
Yes.
So it can be kind of this like toxic cycle.
Yes. Know? But I guess my question is what advice would you have for people who feel really passionate about a vegan diet or a paleo or, you know, whatever label you're giving your blog or your way of eating, who want to share that? Is there a better way, a different way for us to share it? Or do we need to put, I guess, how do we manage that, I suppose, is my question.
Yeah. I mean, so I think of a couple of things. First of all, I would separate vegan from paleo or other things like that because, you know, vegan, you can be vegan and do it just for ethical reasons, do mm-hmm. it for animal rights and the environment. And that is a very different stance and that doesn't have to be disordered mm-hmm. Versus being vegan for health reasons or for weight loss reasons. Mm-hmm. And so if you're pursuing it for like personal health or weight loss, it can get really messy. It can get really tied up with, for weight loss, of course, that's very tied up with diet culture, obviously.
Yes.
But for health reasons too, there's something called orthorexia, which is unhealthy obsession with healthy eating. And people who do healthy living blogging or Instagram yes. Actually are at greater risk of orthorexia. In fact, one study found that like 50% at least of people on Instagram were 50, I think it was 50% of people on Instagram had met the criteria for orthorexia
yeah.
in this sample that they looked at. And so, you know, it's very high risk sort of field. But I think, you know, if you're doing veganism just for animal rights and ethical reasons, that's kind of a separate thing. That's something mm-hmm. that I have seen, and it's very rare and hard to do because we live in diet culture and it's just everywhere and you know, so many people are wrapped up in it. But the folks who've gone through a process of really making peace with food and their bodies and getting rid of the diet culture beliefs, sometimes can end up in a place, you know, if they decide to be vegan for ethical and animal rights reasons, environmental reasons, like can do that without getting sucked back into the disorder. But I think for everyone else, like the people who are doing paleo or keto or Whole 30 or whatever, you know, any yeah. number of these other diets. And I would say plant-based is included in that in the sense of like plant-based for health reasons or especially for weight loss reasons or body change. That's all part of this new guise of diet culture that yeah. has manifested in the 21st century that I call the wellness diet, where it's going under the guise of wellness, but it's actually about demonizing some foods while elevating others, which is yeah. one of the central components of diet culture. Yes. And, you know, holding up an oppressive ideal of what health is supposed to look like. Yeah. This idea of, you know, whatever it may be, right? It's going to look different if you're keto versus if you're paleo versus if you're plant-based versus if you're Whole 30. But that thing that is being held up as the uber example of health is actually really oppressive to people. And yeah. so, you know, I think it's really worth considering. I totally understand because I've been there. Like yeah. I was also attracted to food writing and I wrote a lot about gluten-free foods. That was kind of my little jam.
That was your thing.
Yeah, totally.
We all have our little thing, right? Yeah. Mine is red meat. I'm just not. But I guess for argument's sake, I mean, I haven't got a thing with gluten, but let's just take that as an example, just because you said it. I mean, what if you have read study after study, or you've Googled, or you've, you know, done some proper research, and what you have found suggests that gluten causes inflammation, causes digestive issues, causes whatever, you know, whatever. And you really genuinely believe that this is gospel, and you can see that so-and-so is suffering with digestive issues, which is why you then start your blog and you create all these non, you know, gluten-free recipes. So, you know, when your intention is genuine, because you want to help people, you know, cure their IBS or whatever it is there a better way to do that that is non-restrictive or, yeah, I don't know if you have any thoughts around that, if I'm making sense.
Yeah, totally. Yeah? I think it's all in how you frame it, right? Okay. And all in how you come to it. So, you know, I think that with the gluten stuff, there actually isn't any evidence that it causes disease or that it's problematic for anyone except people who have celiac disease.
Yeah.
And that is a genuine condition that can be diagnosed by, yeah. you know, regular medical professionals. And in that case, if someone does have celiac disease that's diagnosed, they need to avoid gluten. There's this sort of subtle category that is no longer really thought to be real, which is non-celiac gluten sensitivity, which research has shown isn't actually due to gluten at all. And yeah. so, you know, anyone who thinks they have a sensitivity to gluten, but they don't have, you know, they've been tested, they've gone through the tests with a regular medical doctor and they don't have celiac disease. I think it's worth questioning, like, what else might be going on? What's going on in your relationship with food mm-hmm. that's making you fear gluten, that's making you have, you know, IBS or other digestive issues or skin conditions or foggy brain or fatigue or thyroid problems. By the way, all things that I had in mm-hmm. my own disordered eating that I eventually realized and, you know, through a lot of research have come to find a lot of people experience this, that were caused by the disordered eating itself, that were caused by not eating enough food or restricting and binging or restricting and overexercising mm-hmm. and, you know, being increasingly fearful of food and anxious when I was eating. And so, you know, IBS, the thyroid condition was triggered, the fatigue, the foggy brain, like all the things that our society that, you know, the wellness diet really tends to blame on things like gluten mm-hmm. or dairy or other foods that are the sort of scapegoat of the moment. you know, it actually has a lot more to do with how we're eating, like if we're eating enough, if we're eating a wide enough variety of foods, how we're relating to food and how we're feeling about food and our anxiety levels around that, as well as how, you know, whether we're over-exercising and putting that stress on our bodies. So that's sort of like a sidebar just to kind of address.
Yeah, I appreciate that.
How some people come to gluten-free or whatever. But I think, for example, if you're someone with celiac disease, if you've been diagnosed with celiac disease, you start eating gluten-free and you feel a whole lot better. You know, that is totally understandable, right? Because that is a condition that, yes, does necessitate a gluten-free way of eating, and people feel immensely better when they have celiac disease and they're taking out this thing that their body just is not genetically capable of processing. Mm-hmm. And so it's so natural in that case, you know, and I've known people like this who started a food blog because they were celiac and they wanted to bring delicious gluten-free recipes to the world. Yeah. And it is kind of hard in some, you know, especially with baking, like to get the hang of gluten-free. And so there's some art to it. There's some nuance to like mm-hmm. learning how to master that way of cooking. But I would say there, you know, the preaching of the gospel is where it gets really problematic, right? Where people want to just shout it from the rooftops, like, I feel so much better without gluten. And, you know, granted, for someone with celiac disease, that might be real, but I worry about putting that message out there for people who don't have celiac disease, who are watching or listening, for people who are coming to it from a disordered place, you know, where they're having lots of digestive discomfort and disordered, you know, or problems with their gut because of disordered eating that they're experiencing. Yeah. And so suddenly they come to this blog and they see this person being like, gluten-free is the best. It's the only yeah. way. It makes you feel amazing. It's going to yeah. change your life. That's really triggering. That's really problematic for those people who are vulnerable. And I would argue that pretty much anyone in our culture who's reading your food blog is vulnerable. Anyone yeah. who's seeking out food information in this yes. culture with the diet culture that we're steeped in is in a vulnerable state, you know? And so, because why are they even interested in it in the first yeah. place? There's, yeah. you know, of course, exceptions to that. There's those people who are just, you know, have always really loved food and they became chefs, and it's nothing to do with disorder. It's all about just like the love of food and the artistry of it. But that's a really rare kind of special segment of the population. I think mm-hmm. the vast majority of people, and some evidence suggests that 75% of women have some form of disordered eating, and you know, it's like 75% total have either disordered eating or an eating disorder. Yeah. Of those, 10% have like what could be clinically diagnosed as a full-blown eating disorder, even though far fewer are actually diagnosed.
Yeah.
Right? So, and you know, that evidence, whenever I say that to people, whenever I say like the 75% number, you know, people are usually like, that seems low to me. I feel like
I was going to say, I mean, I think anybody who was alive during the Jane Fonda times in the mm-hmm. 80s, like, definitely. Like, it was impossible to escape, right? Like, I totally. Think. And then I also think something you discussed earlier, which kind of, you know, sort of coincides with the stuff that I've discovered, is I think eating disorders, disordered eating, or a complicated relationship with food is even more prominent within the food blogging space, and especially the wellness food blogging space. Mm-hmm. And I also think what's really interesting is that for, you know, a lot of, especially vegan, which is the space that I best know. I don't follow a lot of paleo food blogs just because, you know, it's not my jam. But you know, within the kind of vegan food scene, there are a lot of food bloggers who make vegan desserts every single day, you know, for Instagram to photograph. And, you know, many of them are very, very slim. Mm-hmm. And if I, you know, I know how these desserts are made, they're made with lots of cashew and dates, and they're really dense. And so I'm kind of wondering if they make this, or better said, I know a lot of people make this and then they just throw it out. Mm-hmm. And yet it's almost creating this almost false image, as it were, like, look, I'm eating this and I look amazing. When actually, in fact, you're making this and then you're throwing it out. Like, it's a sort of kind of very weird thing. Or even people who have regular baking vlogs, like lots of them are baking cakes all the time and then not actually eating them, which is kind of a really weird thing if you think about it. I don't know if you you know, if you've had any thoughts around that.
Oh my God. Yeah. It's so sad. I think that's really true. And it also is, you know, the fact that people are associating their image, the image of slimness with their food and showing what they eat. And like, you know, I know that you've talked about like, people showing, you know, what I eat in a day, you know, things on Instagram and stuff. Right. So that creates this sense of like that you're supposedly, you know, the viewer is supposedly getting a window into how this person eats and then seeing an image of them or many images of them really that are sort of like, you know, these slim, you know, usually it's like slim, young, mostly white, affluent enough to afford all these specialty ingredients, you know, outwardly healthy, right? Able-bodied, all of these things that are held up as this oppressive picture of health, you know, is that's what the wellness diet's picture of health looks like. And when people are associating their own image with that picture of health and then saying like, here's what I eat, it's even if they don't make the direct connection, which a lot of them don't, although some people explicitly do, like they'll say, eat like this and you'll look like me. Mm-hmm. Most of the time it's not explicit though, you know,
it's there.
Exactly.
Yes.
And it's, you know, the people watching, of course they're going to believe that. Like if I eat this way, I'll look like this person. And so it becomes this sort of unintentional endorsement of like, here's how to get this body.
Yeah. And I think, again, my sense is from the few blogs that I've seen or the Instagram stories that I've seen is that people's intentions are genuinely really good. You know, like they're showing their workout routine and they're doing a list of what I eat. And my guess is those posts are also really popular. Mm-hmm. So how can we move away from portraying food in this way? And because you kind of talked earlier about framing it differently. So could you give a couple of examples of how we can still create our food blogs, how we can still share the food that we love, but frame it in a more helpful and in a healthier way?
Yeah, such a great question. I think one thing is showing diversity in your eating and your exercise. And what I mean by that is, you know, not just having your whole feed be full of pictures of greens and vegetables and, you know, whole grains or whatever it is that you are sort of, you know, gluten-free, whatever it is that's your sort of jam, mm-hmm. but also showing pictures of you eating a hot dog or you eating a sandwich or whatever, like showing like other foods that are part of a really diverse relationship with food. Or, you know, if you're someone who is vegan for animal and environmental reasons, animal rights and environmental reasons, showing yourself eating, you know, vegan versions of things that are not just the sort of like holistic, healthy, plant-based, you know, flavor of the moment where it's all these beautiful, like eat the rainbow kind of pictures, mm-hmm. but also like eating a vegan hot dog, eating like...
Mm-hmm. Which I do, by the way.
Yeah.
I guess the problem with that is, I'm taking what you're saying on board for sure. And I so hope people who are listening in will do the same. Sometimes the problem with those things, I'm super open about the fact that I have, you know, junk food as, you know, just like everybody else. Like I'm not healthy. I've never kind of portrayed myself as the healthy food blogger. But the problem with some of those foods are that they're not very pretty to photograph. So it's just in terms of, and which is why I also think a lot of the bloggers are doing what I eat in a day and all this stuff because they bring in the ratings, they increase your follower number. But I guess what I'm hearing you say is that if our mission is to really inspire, is to be more genuine and authentic in showing everything, because in the long run, it's going to be more helpful. Yeah. Am I mm-hmm. getting that right?
Totally. Yeah. I think it's, you know, it's going to be more helpful to show a diversity of foods and, mm-hmm. you know, with the, what I eat in a day, it might seem like that's a way to sort of show yourself authentically and like mix in a few things that are less, you know, pretty or quote unquote healthy, traditionally healthy and stuff. But actually those are also really problematic because, you know, what I eat in a day is basically like a recipe for, you know, it's like someone with a disordered relationship with food, which so many people have. have could use that as like their meal plan, right? It's like, okay, I just need to eat exactly this way and I'll look exactly like this person. Yeah. And so it can really fan the flames of disordered eating. So I know that that stuff is, you know, ratings gold, that it gets, it gets lots of likes, it gets lots of views. And I think that's symptomatic of where we are as a culture, as you know, that everybody is increasingly obsessed with food, as I said, and that we have this wellness diet, which is the new guise of diet culture, which is making people seek out pictures of healthy food and clean eating and, you know, whatever, all the stuff. And so I think to be ethical media producers, we need to push back on that, you know, even if it means fewer clicks, or we need to find ways, you know, we need to get creative. It means just getting more creative with the content that we produce until we find something that does bring in the likes and the views and stuff. You know, I have like 35,000 Instagram followers. I almost never show pictures of myself. It's all quotes from my podcast. Yeah. And, you know, with the occasional like photo from an event or something thrown in. And so that's been my way, you know, that's been sort of like an organically derived way that I found, where it's something, it's stuff that I enjoy sharing, I feel comfortable sharing, and it's stuff that resonates with my audience. And, you know, not that 35,000 is like the most followers ever, but it's been, you know, I've only been doing it for a couple of years and it's been slowly growing all the time. And it feels good. It feels like the right, you know, the right thing for me. And so I think just kind of, you know, to anyone out there who has a blog or an Instagram following that they want to grow, thinking about ways that feel authentic to you, that feel nourishing to you, and that you know aren't going to be triggering to people watching it or reading it, but that, you know, you can get creative and find these other ways of doing things. So instead of a what I eat in a day or whatever, maybe it's like messy Mondays where you show like, you know, the failed attempts at like recipe styling, or, you know, you show the foods that you ate that are really unphotogenic, but you like put it through a filter and make it kind of cool, or you crop it in an interesting way or whatever.
Yeah. Like, I mean, to be honest, I think for me, my blog actually has warped into much more of a food photography blog, and that's what I do now. But I'm always looking for things that are really challenging to photograph. So I mentioned this on a podcast the other day. You know, sometimes I get really horrible French fries. Like here, we call them chips in London, and they're really fat. And some, you know, sometimes they're nice and crisp, sometimes they're really soggy. And so my challenge is going to be to photograph them in a really sexy way, catch up and all. And I'll tag you in it when I do that. Christy, I know, actually, can I ask you one more question before I sort of bring it to a close, just because, I'd love to have your thoughts on this. So, and also full disclosure, I'm a qualified nutritional therapist, but I'm super open to, you know, way more than I do, and I've got way more qualifications. But one of my reasons for going plant-based actually was, you know, reading the China study, and I did quite a lot of research into the effect of meat and dairy and those sorts of things. And I guess I'm not sure I'm able to move or shift. Well, I'm not, I don't know how I feel about not waving the plant-based flag when I'm not sure if I believe, well, Bender said, I'm 100% sure that eating plant-based isn't going to make you thinner necessarily, or is going to make you gain weight or anything like that. But sort of from a cancer perspective, I do feel quite strongly about it. Mm-hmm. But I also want to be really cautious that that isn't my sort of, you know, covert way of actually moving into wellness. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you can speak to that.
Yeah, I think that's a great question. And I think anyone who's familiar with science or reads the headlines about the studies, you know, I think it's easy to pick up this idea that like, certain foods are better for your health, certain foods are bad for your health, certain foods should be avoided, you know, especially with like the research on plant-based diets. It's like there is some evidence that seems to suggest that, you know, if you want to live longer or cancer-free, that going plant-based could help you. But I think we have to look at that science with a critical lens, because it comes out of diet culture.
Yeah.
You know, the way that we frame and interpret and do the research on nutrition is all coming from a lens of some foods are good and other foods are bad, and let's figure out what those are, you know, and the people who do nutritional research are human beings that are steeped in diet culture, just like everyone else. And especially, you know, people who go into nutrition research arguably are the most interested in the effects of nutrition on health and the most sort of influenced by that type of thinking. And so, you know, there's that old saying, when you're a hammer, everything looks like a nail, right? So if you're a nutritional scientist looking at the purported effects of food on health, everything's going to look like it's the nutrition piece. Mm-hmm. But nutritional studies almost never control, like it's surprising and shocking how often they don't control for things like race, education, you know, the sort of socioeconomic status of a person. And also they don't look at, like, there's almost no studies. I talked to a researcher who is maybe doing the first ever study. She thinks she's never heard of it before, and she came across it because she was working with a psychologist. But she's doing maybe the first ever study that's controlling for disordered eating behaviors. Yeah. Almost no, other than that, no nutritional science that I've ever looked at controls for disordered eating behaviors, which is mind-boggling, right? Yeah. And or dieting behaviors, you know? And so when you look at, like, for example, the people who eat the most meat and dairy, there's a couple things that could be going on that the research doesn't control for, and that could actually be explaining the differential health outcomes. One is poverty. And, you know, we know that poverty is associated with all kinds of adverse health effects across the board, and that, you know, people who are poorer are also more likely to choose convenience foods, fast foods, you know, foods that are cheap and available and easy, because they don't have the money to afford, nor the time, you know, the labor to afford to put into making food from scratch, right? And so the association, it might be that, you know, the food is just a confounding, you know, sort of a symptom, right? The food is just one other factor, but that actually it's the poverty that's leading to these poor health outcomes via other mechanisms like stress and discrimination and, you know, economic adversity, like keeping people from getting adequate health care and things like that. The other piece is that disordered eating and dieting behaviors and weight cycling are independently associated with negative health outcomes too. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if someone is eating, I mean, a classic example of this I think of is when I look at the research on sugar, but we can think of it, you know, also with the research on like dairy or meat or something. The people who are eating the most of those types of things, you know, since we don't have research that controls for binge eating behavior, mm-hmm. right? And when you look at the actual quintiles, I mean, this is getting very sciencey now, but like when, you know, nutrition science is conducted, it's never like in a lab, or almost never in a lab, where they monitor someone's eating minutely for weeks or months and, you know, record everything. It's like the people are free living, they're out in the world doing their thing, and then they self-report. Yeah. What they're eating, right? And so when they self-report what they're eating, the researchers divide the people into, usually it's four or five groups, so quartiles or quintiles of consumption. And the people in the lowest quintile or quartile are the reference group. And then the people in the higher quintiles or quartiles are compared to that reference group in terms of, you know, who has higher levels of heart disease, who has higher levels of cancer, et cetera, et cetera. Well, when you actually look at what the people in those different quartiles or quintiles consume, like the amount of that food they're consuming, the ones in the lowest quartile or quintile usually consume an amount that to me is like pretty indicative of a normal, healthy, balanced relationship with food. Mm-hmm. They're not consuming zero. It's not like they're never eating sugar, or they're not eating any dairy. You know, maybe some of the members of that group are eating no dairy or no meat, but on average, they're eating some, but not a ton. And then you go up the quartiles or quintiles, and the people in the highest level of consumption usually have staggering levels of consumption of these foods, where you think, like, there's got to be something going on for this person. Mm-hmm. You know, if they're eating that much sugar in a day, or they're eating that much meat, like, there's something happening in their relationship with food or in their lifestyle. Like, it's, you know, poverty or lack of resources or binge eating disorder, right? And we just don't know, because we're not controlling for those things. Mm-hmm. But so you know, when you see this research that says like higher levels of meat consumption are associated with XYZ health outcome, you really need to look at like what are the people actually consuming in these studies. And across the board, you know, whenever I've done this, whenever I've looked at the actual study and seen like how much of this food are these people consuming, it's always like, oh yeah, it's not zero. It's not austere. It's not, they're not on some special diet. Yeah. You know, the people with sugar, like the people who are in the lowest quartile or quintile of consumption are eating sweets every day, and they're eating sweetened foods at every meal and maybe a big dessert at night. You know, it's not like they're eating no sugar. It's not like the people in the lowest levels with dairy are eating no dairy, you know? And yeah. So that's really what I would say in terms of health concerns, is that we need to like really be critical about the science and yeah. understand that the way it gets interpreted, the way that, you know, both the researchers write their introductions and conclusions is informed by diet culture. If you want to see the assumptions of the researchers, look at the conclusions or the discussion yeah. section of a study. But if you want to see the actual meat of what the study contains, like no pun intended, the actual, you know, content of the study, mm-hmm. you got to look at the methods and the results section. And you see what's actually going on, but then you get their interpretation in the discussion section, and that's what gets used to write the press releases mm-hmm. that then get used to write the articles about the studies. And so where that, you know, people's diet culture lens comes into play there, because what they're selecting as the mediagenic results of the studies, right? It's like, red meat will give you cancer. You know, that's kind yeah. of the interpretation that you get from the conclusions of the study and then the press release and then the articles. And so that's what gets disseminated to the public. And of course, it just reinforces what we've already been conditioned to believe by diet culture, which is like certain foods are bad and will give you cancer, you yeah. know,
instead but of... I think kind of hearing you talk, what's really coming through, I mean, I even realized that when I was studying, is that the headlines is actually nothing to do with what nutrition really is. It's so much more complex. And in lots of ways, it feels like it's just the tip of the iceberg that we're starting to really grasp how food, you know, acts in the body and the impact and all of it. And my worry is, and has always been, that, you know, these really well-intending food bloggers take some bits and bobs that they've seen here and there, or maybe they've read a book here and there, to then create a whole diet around it, when actually what all that you've just said really shows we need to go into the nitty-gritty. And writing a food blog, when you take that health stance, needs to be super well-informed and fully educated. If not, it might cause more damage than good.
Absolutely. Mm. And I would even argue, you know, taking a health stance, I mean, I'm a health professional, right? I'm a dietitian. I have a master's in public health. I trained and got a license to sort of equip me to give health advice to the general public. And yet I don't really do that. I mean, I do think that what I do is helping people be healthier in the sense of healing their relationships with food and yeah. learning to become intuitive eaters again. But I'm not out there saying you should eat more of this and less of that, or add more of this superfood into your life or anything like that, because that nutrition messaging always gets filtered through the lens of diet culture in people's yeah. minds, and definitely creates more harm than good.
Yeah. You know?
People have heard every way to Sunday that they're supposed to be eating differently. They've jumped from this diet to that diet to the other diet to, you know, following so-and-so's advice and then this other guru over here. They don't need any more gurus. Yeah. They don't need any more people telling them what to do. Yeah. They need people helping them reconnect with what they already know, you know, their intuition that they were born with. And honestly, when you do that, when you can get back in touch with your intuitive eating skills, nutrition falls into place. You know, nutrition mm-hmm. is the 10th principle of intuitive eating, and there are 10, so it's the last principle of intuitive eating. And it's gentle nutrition can play a role in people's relationship with food and in a, you know, sort of well-balanced life. But it's just one of the 10 principles, and it can't come until people have stripped away all of the diet culture stuff. The first principle is reject the diet mentality. Yeah. And that's where we have to begin, because the diet mentality is how diet culture manifests in people's minds as individuals. And that's where we're so tied up. That's where we're so caught up and, you know, having so much trouble. And so any nutrition information that gets thrown at someone when they're in the diet mentality just gets filtered through that lens and used really as a stick to beat yourself with, mm-hmm. instead of as something that can actually help you take care of yourself, which is ultimately what I help people to do with nutrition when they're ready. But it's, spoiler alert for anyone who is wanting to do this intuitive eating journey and is early on, gentle nutrition is like so basic. It's not, it's not like food combining or this and that protein is, take this out of your diet. It's so, so chill. Like it's just basic, basic nutrition to help you power yourself through life and feel your best and not anything more than that.
I think it's wonderful. And what it also does, it's kind of, it's now the wellness industry is a multi-billion dollar industry, right? And it's kind of stripping all of that away and bring it back to basics. It sounds wonderful, Christy. Thank you so, so much for sharing all your insight and knowledge and also giving me so much food for thought, no pun intended either. Now, I have three questions that I always ask my guests, and we've spoken so much about the sort of darker side of food, but taking it from a lighter angle, I would love to know what your favorite thing to eat is.
Such a good question. I mean, it changes all the time, I think. So all-time favorite, probably Reese's Peanut Butter Cups.
Nice.
Current favorite is these like rice chips with honey mustard flavor on them. I really love anything honey mustard, honestly, like potato chips with honey mustard sauce, any of that is delicious. And in terms of like a meal or something to eat, I really love Korean food. I'm a huge fan of bibimbap.
Nice. Yeah. You know, I've not actually experimented much with Korean food this. So good. Thank you. What is your favorite thing to capture with your camera?
Yeah, you might think it would be food, but it's really not. Like these days, I don't take many pictures of food. I like to take pictures of my husband in front of like cool monuments we're seeing, or vacation photos, like a cool landscape or something in the background. And I don't like to just take pictures of the landscapes because I feel like that's boring. So I like to have a person in them.
Yeah, I'm the same. And now, last but not least, what is your most favorite thing to share?
I think my favorite thing to share is this message that we don't have to be caught up in diet culture, that we don't have to obsess about food all the time, or that food and health and wellness don't need to occupy such a huge amount of brain space, that we actually are so much more and have so much more in our lives and so much more potential in our lives. If we can let that stuff go and just get back in touch with our internal cues about food so that we can free up all that mental space that was devoted to food and body stuff for other bigger, better things.
Wonderful. Thank you. Would you be so kind as to let us know where we can find you?
Absolutely. Yeah. So my website is sort of the hub for everything I do. It's ChristyHarrison.com. And there you can find information about my podcast, which is called Food Psych. You can also find that on any podcast platform. So wherever you're listening to this, if you type in Food Psych, which is FOOD space PSYCH, no E on the end. People always want to put an E, but it's just CH. You'll find it there as well.
Fantastic. And I'll pop all those in the show notes. Thank you so, so much for your wisdom and your time, and hope to get you on the podcast again sometime in the future.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
Take care.
You too.
How awesome, cool, and knowledgeable is Christy? I'm so happy that she agreed to be on the Eat Capture Share podcast to share all that she knows with you. And I hope you found today's episode as thought-provoking and helpful as I did. In fact, I would love to know what you made of today's episode. So by all means, please drop me a DM on Instagram. I'm The Little Plantation there. Or you're also very welcome to send me a quick email at kimberly@thelittleplantation.co.uk. I would love to know your thoughts about this and all the other previous episodes. As always, I love seeing your thoughts and feedback about the podcast on Instagram stories. It's my absolute most favorite thing. So if you had a takeaway, or if you feel that this is content that your audience can benefit from, then please do share on Instagram stories, and I'll be sure to repost on my stories if you tag me so I can see you. Before I leave you, firstly, I just wanted to say thank you so, so much for tuning in and listening. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. I'd also like to let you know that this podcast was brought to you by my free creative community, the Food Photo Insta Creative Community on Facebook, and I would love for you to join. I will pop the notes of how you can join my creative community down in the show notes, so do go and check it out. Also, if you enjoy the podcast, it would mean so much if you can rate, review, and subscribe. All those things will help the podcast to grow and to reach the right audience. And yeah, you'd kind of make my day. All right, see you soon. Take care. Bye.